Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. The usual two guests today, the Texas-based immigration attorney Brianna Renix will tell us what's happening at the U.S.-Mexico border, and John Paulo Biocchi will discuss his strategy for keeping distressed housing out of the hands of private equity and putting it instead in the hands of its residents through a public social housing authority. Before that, a few words on the American Rescue Plan Act, a grandiose name if there ever was one. But the thing is large. Judging from my social media feeds, there are a lot of people who just don't get how large it is. With the reduction of the promised $2,000 checks to $1,400 and the stripping out of the $15 minimum wage provisions to earn the votes of a few ghoulish centrist Democrats, the idea spread that there was nothing left in the bill. There's a lot in the bill, which Biden will sign into law on Friday. Aside from the $1,400 checks, which will go to about 85% of the population, the act also extends $300 supplemental unemployment benefits through Labor Day, they were supposed to expire at the end of March, and lifts the tax on those benefits. The bill also provides a $3,000 per child allowance to parents, raises food stamp benefits by 15%, offers $25 billion in aid to renters with unpaid debts to landlords, gives $350 billion in aid to state, local, and tribal governments, $130 billion to schools, and $40 billion to college and universities so they can safely reopen, and also throws over $30 billion into the coffers of public transit systems hammered by the crisis. And it provides over $160 billion in aid for fighting COVID, from vaccines to testing to clinics to R&D. And those are only the highlights. Together, the act will boost the income of the bottom 20% of the income distribution by about 20% over the coming year. But while some pundits are spinning this bill as targeting mainly poor people, the so-called middle class will also benefit enormously. It's sad to see coverage that pits the poor against the middle ranks, since programs like these can foster solidarity by revealing a common material interest in income support and other forms of public spending. Especially true in a crisis like this, where people who thought they were middle class find themselves suddenly poor in a country that's deeply hostile to poor people. The upper orders love to pit the poor against the middle. It distracts from how they lord it over the rest of us. Too many of these provisions are temporary. I hope that as people come to enjoy these benefits, there will be massive political pressure to make them permanent. The right understands that anything that raises expectations is dangerous to their class rule, which is why they so relentlessly oppose even the smallest concessions to generosity. It was said that Manchin and Sinema and few other conservative Dems killed a minimum wage increase, which would greatly improve the lives of scores of millions. The federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour was last raised in July 2009. Its real value is now 18% below that level. After that rise, the minimum was 39% of the average hourly wage. It's now eroded to 29% of that average, an all-time low. The real value of the current minimum wage is the same as it was in 1995 and is lower than it was during the near four-decade span from 1950 through 1989. The doomed proposal by Biden et al. To raise the minimum to 15 would take it well above its all-time peak, in real terms, of $11.12 that was set in February 1967. Then it was 53% of the average wage. An immediate rise to 15 would take it to 60% of the average wage, which is what it was in 1939 and again in 1950. In other words, a proposal to bring the minimum wage back to the standard of 1939 or 1950 is attracting outrage and dire predictions of job loss and inflation. A major increase in the minimum wage is massively popular, and opponents of the increase should be made to suffer for their obstinacy. What's going on in the southern border? How many of Trump's brutal policies is Biden continuing? Was Trump as much of a departure from Obama and his predecessors as you might think? To answer those questions, here's Brianna Renix. They're an attorney who works with detained asylum seekers in Texas. Renix is also a senior editor at Current Affairs magazine. Brianna Renix. We're hearing an awful lot of stuff about what's going on the border. Social media is full of kids in cages. Nobody cares because it's not Trump anymore. Set us straight. What exactly is going on at the border right now? How different is it from the Trump days?
First of all, it's pretty early days yet to know what's going to unfold ultimately at the border. The Biden administration has definitely expressed the desire to change some of the policies of the Trump era, for example. they announced that they are phasing out the Remain in Mexico program, which was trapping a lot of asylum seekers in pretty dangerous border towns in Mexico, though it's not clear exactly how that phase out is going to work logistically and whether relief is going to be provided to people who were already disadvantaged by that program. In terms of detention practices at the border, especially with kids, it's a little bit difficult to untangle exactly what's happening now and what's going to happen in the future, in part because Trump introduced some new policies at the border that were different from Obama. He continued some policies of the Obama administration. And then there were some new COVID-era policies that were rolled out ostensibly in the name of public health. For a while, the Trump administration was using this public health order promulgated by the CDC as pretty broad authority to bounce lots of people back from the border, including for a period of time unaccompanied children who were presenting themselves at the border to ask for asylum, to just bounce them back from the border without giving them any kind of opportunity to ask for protection or have any hearing on their claims. The Biden administration is continuing to use that CDC order, from what we can tell, to bounce some people back, including families with children. They have indicated that they, at this time, are not wanting to apply that policy to unaccompanied children. What that's resulted in part, is that there's now larger numbers of unaccompanied children coming across the border because people feel like that is a safer way to ensure that their children make it into the U.S. because they're being allowed across.
What is driving this flow of unaccompanied children?
Flows of migration generally have been driven by pretty consistent factors since at least the Obama years. A lot of migrants, especially from Central America, who are fleeing conditions of poverty, violence, sometimes state violence, sometimes violence by non-state actors. There's also the desire to reunite with family members who are already in the U.S. And so that's been driving migration, both of individual adults and families. Unaccompanied children sometimes are traveling unaccompanied because they were sent alone because they don't have an adult to come with them. Sometimes unaccompanied minors cross the border alone because they're told to by smugglers, because smugglers who are kind of watching everything that happens at the border are aware that adults are treated worse than children, and so they think that children will have a better shot if they come alone. Some unaccompanied children are not really unaccompanied. They come with adults who are family friends or who are relatives that are not their legal guardians. And in some situations, they are separated from those adults at the border.
Now, I think the Trump innovation was separating children from families with a frequency and severity that hadn't been seen before. Is that true, and has that changed?
Family separation is something that has gone on at the border for quite some time before Trump. For example, as I said, kids who come to the border with adult caretakers who are not their legal guardians are separated from those adults in many situations. Sometimes the government would separate children from fathers because they didn't have detention facilities that could hold adult men and children at the same time. It was relatively rare for mothers to be separated from children. During that period of very high-profile family separations, that consistent punitive separation of mothers from children was the part that was very new and frightening. That phase, however, was quite brief. And then after that, the sort of family separations that resumed were kind of consistent with the types of separations that had occurred in the earlier part of the Trump administration and under the Obama administration before. That's to say that family separations were not an innovation of the Trump administration. The specific type of family separation that people got very agitated about was something that was specific to the Trump administration, but it was also quite short-lived.
What did they do afterwards? It's short-lived. Well, then what kind of policy succeeded it?
Typically what happens when a mother comes to the border with a child is they get sent to what's called a family detention center. So the mother and children are sent to the same detention center together. And in most cases, they're put in this super fast deportation process called expedited removal, where the government gives them a very high stakes, very fast interview on their asylum claim. And if they pass, they might get to stay in the U.S. to continue pursuing their asylum claim. And if they fail, they get deported very quickly.
I'm guessing the pass rate in those is not very high.
There's variation in that. So these centers were actually set up under the Obama administration. They were originally intended to be deportation factories. But there was a lot of coordination to provide legal services at those facilities. And as it turns out, when you actually provide legal representation to people and you give them some kind of orientation to the legal requirements for asylum, people actually meet the legal qualifications and they pass their interviews. So once people started having legal representation, those numbers went up by a lot. Under the Trump administration, not only did he keep those family detention centers open, but especially in the second half of the Trump administration, a lot of policies were geared towards obstructing access to counsel at those facilities and also sort of coming up with just a barrage of new rules and policies that were supposed to restrict people's eligibility for protection. And that resulted in some families being detained at that center for well over a year, children, very little children, in detention centers for over a year. This detention of families and subjecting them to this process has been going on since the Obama administration, continued through the Trump administration, and got in some ways worse under the Trump administration. What Biden will do with these facilities going forward is very unclear. They've made some public noise about rebranding them as family reception centers, where people will only be held for about 72 hours before being released. But there's been very little clarity about what that means.
I read one story that said they were trying to turn them into, like, modern Ellis Islands. Is there any truth to that?
It's kind of difficult to know how to apply that metaphor because these centers have already been used previously as congregate facilities where families are held, where they're subjected to sort of very onerous and traumatic screening procedures to determine who's going to be let in and who isn't. So that's been the status quo. And that is sort of the Ellis Island model. Going forward, the Biden administration has indicated that they want something to change about these family detention centers and how they operate, but they have not at any point said that they intend to close them. These centers are quite expensive to run and operate. So when the government commits to keeping a center open, even if they're claiming that it's not going to have the same level of utility that it had before, you do kind of have to wonder if they are sort of keeping it on the back burner so that they can fill it up again in the future if they decide to start detaining people en masse.
These guys have only been in office for less than 2 months. Is it fair to say, given time, or should they have done more and better by now?
There are certainly some promises that they committed to that they've not fulfilled. One of the most dramatic ones was they promised to had this 100-day moratorium on deportations. That got challenged in court, and the government really didn't fight very hard against that court order and also didn't roll out the moratorium in a way that people would legally think was a way that was likely to be successful. So it's not clear to me whether the Biden administration ever intended that moratorium to be successful. The Biden administration has also said that they want to change some of their enforcement priorities so that they are not focusing on, for example, people who don't have criminal records, aside from whether you think that that's not a problematic designation. It's also not on the ground level, not clear that they're actually following those guidelines yet. It is only 2 months in. There have been some moves that have been made, like the commitment to ending MPP, that are positive, potentially. But everything is the devil is always in the details and how these things are rolled out and how they're enforced on the ground level. And also whether people who have already sort of suffered under Trump-era policies are going to get any relief for what was already done to them. So there's just a lot at this point that's uncertain.
And what about those deportations? I mean, I've heard some people say ICE has just gone rogue. It's operating on its own, and they're not following orders. There are, of course, the court issues. What's the scale of the deportations, and why are they still going on, or what changes have there been?
Deportations are still happening. It's something where at the top, they put out guidelines about who is sort of a priority for deportation, but that doesn't really legally bind the government to anything. So they can say, oh, you know, someone's not a priority for deportation, but that doesn't make it therefore illegal to deport that person if they have an order of removal. So what that means is that on the sort of level of individual ICE offices, especially because they haven't really been given additional guidance about how to enforce these policies, they're making a lot of decisions on their own about what these guidelines mean. And that means that they're still choosing to deport people in many places. So that is certainly continuing.
And when we talk about children, are we talking about 2-year-olds, 16-year-olds?
So children of all ages come to the border to seek protection, either sometimes by themselves, although those children tend to be a little bit older. They would need to be able to approach the border themselves. But coming with families, you know, you have children who are of all ages, from very, very young to teenagers. Since the Obama years, it's become very normalized to detain children. And I just want to draw the distinction a little bit between facilities that are designed to hold families and facilities that are designed to hold unaccompanied children. So there's been a lot of noise about, like, the government is opening new baby cages. And that is true. They are opening new facilities to hold unaccompanied children. And the companies that run those facilities have a pretty bad track record of caring for kids. So this is not a positive development. At the same time, when you have children who come to the border without guardians, you do have to figure out some way to care for them while you connect them with the family member that they're coming to join in the U.S. And so in that respect, the government does have a logistical problem on its hands that it has to solve in some way. I think that a lot of that logistical problem could be eliminated if they just allowed children to enter the U.S. with their family members without being detained. But since they don't allow that, they're incentivizing children to cross alone, and so they're going to have to keep dealing with that problem. And then, meanwhile, for children who do come with guardians already, there's no reason to hold them in detention prior to release because they already have their guardian with them. So something like family detention very clearly serves no actual function except to punish and deter families from coming to seek asylum here, and also to sort of act as a bottleneck where the government can try to rapidly deport some of them.
I'm speaking with the immigration attorney, Brianna Renix.
The officers on the ground, from a distance, they seem, I'm sort of say, kind of like brutal people. How much of the poor treatment of migrants is a result of bad cops?
It's a complicated picture, right? On the one hand, when you have vulnerable people in unseen places, like remote parts of the border, like holding facilities and detention centers where day-to-day people can't see what's happening, that always very strongly incentivizes abusive and neglectful behavior. And so I think everybody who's come into contact with a detention center has seen countless examples of things like that happening, and it's very upsetting. At the same time, a lot of the things that make immigrants and asylum seekers' lives miserable emanates from the pens of bureaucrats and the high-level decisions of policymakers who impose sort of arbitrary and onerous restrictions on people's ability to qualify for relief, to attend their court hearings, and who also, by perpetuating the system, enable the abuses that happen at detention centers. So I do think that, like, certainly this is a system that enables bad actors to do bad things, but the system itself is the problem, not the individual actors.
What is actually the intention of this system? To really tightly regulate the entry of migrants? What are they trying to accomplish with this regime?
It's not entirely clear. My best guess is that the government knows and has known for a long time that people are going to keep migrating here, that large sectors of our economy also depend on continuous migration flows and have for some time, that the push and pull factors that drive migration are much stronger than any sort of legal and carceral deterrence that the government can come up with. But at the same time, to sort of create the appearance that because you know, both conservatives and liberals like the idea of the border being secure because that has become a political talking point, having this sort of vast system to detain people at the border and show that we're just, like, not letting everybody just walk in. I believe that it's all primarily political theater. And I don't mean theater in the sense that it doesn't have real world impacts, because it does, because the people who suffer under this system, their suffering is very real. But I think that the goal, my impression is usually that the goal the government is trying to accomplish is purely to sort of create a politically advantageous appearance that they are controlling immigration, because that is something that the public has been primed to care about.
In Trump's case, it sure seemed to be an element of visceral xenophobia, especially about Latin Americans. What was the contribution of that to the policy? How did that change relative to the underlying policy, which is obviously not exactly welcoming either?
Yeah, well, what I would say is the immigration system that we have now, with its very heavy emphasis on detention and the many obstacles to obtaining relief, to reuniting with your family, that system has very much been a bipartisan effort. Many of the worst aspects of the system were put in place by Clinton-era policies during the 90s. Much of our detention center was sort of built and fortified under Obama. The contribution of the Trump era, which was quite difficult to manage at the time, and the after effects of which are going to continue to be felt, even if, for example, we have a Democratic administration for like the next 8 years, is that because there were people in the Trump administration who fundamentally believed that as much immigration as possible needed to be stopped and as many immigrants as possible needed to be made miserable, they were just at every conceivable level of policy, of regulation, of law, of presidential decision making, they were launching a constant assault to erode all possible eligibility for relief that people normally would have had. So basically, huge swaths of people who would have been eligible for asylum, they were seeking to strip of eligibility. Protections that exist for children and unaccompanied minors, they were seeking to strip those protections so that those children had even less recourse in the system than they did before. They were seeking to restrict access to counsel at detention centers by any means they could. So that kind of concerted, constant assault on any possibility of relief for people at kind of every level of the immigration system was unique to the Trump era, and it was very disorienting and difficult to marshal the resources to fight that constantly. I do think that that was a sense in which the Trump administration was uniquely bad on immigration in ways that differed from the Obama administration, potentially. And everybody is hopeful that that style of assault on the limited protections that are available under our current immigration regime will not continue into the Biden years. What's less clear is whether Biden is going to actually make any substantive improvements on the sort of status quo that had previously existed before Trump.
Yeah, I would guess that the pre-Trump model was not one of humane internationalism. So if we go back to what existed before, we'll just be back to an unacceptable level of brutality without the extra sauce that Trump brought to it.
Yeah, and it has been pointed out with truth that the highest level of deportations that we've seen in sort of recent history happened under Obama, not under Trump. So in terms of sheer numbers, Obama deported more people than Trump and had a higher annual record of deportations than Trump. I think it's important to realize that different presidents can be very bad in different ways that require different responses from the public and from advocates. So that's to say, I think Trump was uniquely bad in some ways, but Obama was also uniquely bad in some ways. And it remains to be seen kind of where Biden is going to fall on some of these things.
Okay, so say you were the czar of immigration policy. These are really difficult issues, just precisely how many people to let in. Should we have open borders? Should we have semi-open borders? Should we have closed borders? These are all really complicated political questions, both on principle and in practice. But is there a humane way to manage this that you could think of that would treat people well?
This is my personal opinion, I don't believe that immigration should be regulated as it's currently being regulated. I think I'm in favor of open borders. And what I have seen from working inside the immigration system is that the vast majority of our immigration system is focused on derailing and immiserating the lives of very ordinary people who are not a danger to the public, who are not people that pose any threat to anybody. It's a completely illogical and cruel system that serves no tangible function and merely absorbs lots of energy and resources in the process of needlessly destroying the lives of many people.
Well, you can say that the purpose is creating a very insecure, low-wage labor force.
Yeah, I do think that there is something to that. I think that that's certainly having an arbitrary division in the workforce that's created by an arbitrarily imposed legal category like immigration is a way to inhibit organizing. And I think people at the top likely know that. And I think, too, the other thing I think that's important to realize is that, first of all, immigration system very much bound up with the other problems of our carceral state in terms of people who have committed crimes, people being overpunished for those things. Our immigration system also very much double punishes people who have committed crimes, both by detaining people for crimes for which they've already served their time in immigration detention, or imposing really sort of over-the-top punishments within the immigration system for a whole barrage of crimes that have no relation to public safety or any sort of rationale of that kind. So there's, I think, most of the explanations that people imagine to themselves about why we need this kind of immigration system, both in terms of detaining people and in sort of subjecting people to these like very elaborate and complicated and lengthy court processes to adjudicate their status, I think all the explanations that people would imagine for why we need that are not accurate, and that, in fact, we don't need it at all.
That was Brianna Renix, an attorney who works with detained asylum seekers in Texas and who is a senior editor at Current Affairs magazine. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News, back after a musical break. Some of No Borders, No Nation by Anti-Flag, a bit of 2002 vintage political punk out of Pittsburgh. Next, how to deal with a burgeoning housing crisis. Unlike the 2008 financial crisis, which is mostly about homeowners being foreclosed upon, this time millions of renters are also in deep trouble, months behind with no prospect for catching up. That's not to say homeowners aren't in trouble as well, but their problems are being masked by moratoria that are part of the CARES Act and other programs, meaning that their loans are going into forbearance rather than delinquency. Eviction moratoria are also masking trouble for renters. As these moratoria expire, however, problems are likely to become painfully obvious. Private equity titans, who scooped up millions of units during the last crisis, are looking to repeat their predatory attacks again. Here with a better alternative is Gianpaolo Baiocchi, director of the Urban Democracy Lab, professor of individualized studies and sociology at NYU, and author of We, the Sovereign. Baiocchi and several collaborators published a paper in November on how we could create a social housing development authority, which would acquire distressed properties, notably multifamily rental buildings where tenants are way behind on rent, and convert them into non-market forms of social housing. Gianpaolo Baiocchi. Remember from the last housing crisis a decade ago, or a little more than a decade ago, Blackstone certainly cleaned up buying a lot of distressed properties. We don't want to repeat it that this time, right? What's a better way to approach the fact that an awful lot of people may be at risk of losing housing?
We've been trying to figure out what private equity is going to do this time around, and we've actually been able to attend seminars where people are discussing the kind of investments they're planning to do. And they're quite public that they have some $300 billion of dry powder dedicated, and they're seeing this upcoming crisis. The residential real estate is going to fall after commercial and maybe hospitality, but they're seeing a big opportunity. And so we think this would be disastrous. We think private equity should not be profiting and making money off of the misfortune of people. We worry about what will happen once these buildings are in control of private equity. So we think the federal government needs to step in.
What do we know about what private equity did over the last decade with the housing they scooped up?
Different things. Last crisis was mostly a residential crisis. A homeowner's crisis. And a lot of those homes, they purchased and flipped. Some of it has become rental. So when the 10 million or so people lost their homes, they entered the rental market. So one of the things that private equity did do was turn some of that into single-family rentals. There's even documented cases of people renting the very same property that they used to own. There was speculation with some of this property, and there was a tremendous transfer of wealth. The effect on communities of people losing these homes was just disastrous. One of the things we do know, for example, is that the gap in home ownership between blacks and whites now stands at where it was during Jim Crow, because the effect was so concentrated in communities of color.
We also know that black wealth got really hammered during that period and hasn't really recovered.
No.
And for most middle-income people, their wealth is in their housing, insofar as they have any.
Right. You know, we just turned up a pretty incredible statistic that the difference in wealth between renters and owners is 80 times on the average. And it's very difficult for people to accumulate wealth and savings if you're a renter. You know, rent is so expensive, particularly for lower income people, that it's a kind of permanent trap. And we in this country really have not done a very good job of thinking about housing and long-term lives and wealth for the bottom third.
And younger people are having a real terrible time buying.
Yes.
What about social housing? What's the concept mean?
So social housing means lots of things to different people. For us, it means housing that you cannot speculate on. So it's partially outside of the market or fully outside of the market. And there's an element of resident control. So most of the examples people think of when we talk about social housing in the U.S., are the community land trusts, are limited equity cooperatives, are some of these very interesting experiments in the resident-owned communities where people will collectively own the land beneath manufactured homes. It seems to me that the term is gaining some traction, but these are the kinds of things we think. I personally am a big fan of European examples, but I don't think the social housing that will eventually be able to develop in this country is necessarily going to be the Vienna model.
Could you talk some more about that? What about that model?
Vienna has a very high percentage of its residential stock in social housing. So it's government, publicly owned, publicly controlled, residents actually participate in it. It's very, very nice housing, has a very nice middle class, very high percentage of middle class participation. You know, so it doesn't, for people in Vienna, when you say social housing, it doesn't have the connotation that people have with public housing in the United States, for example, as a kind of emergency situation or a kind of marginalized situation or even such a badly funded situation. So the Vienna model emerged at this particular time. You know, it's associated with Red Vienna and with the power of unions.
And that was a point at which the country was run by a rather conservative government, but Vienna managed to carve out its little bit of municipal social democracy.
Exactly. You know, and there's a sort of interesting, another example people talk about in this world of housing alternatives is Montevideo. Even during the military dictatorship, there is some measure of municipal progressivism anchored in this very wide social housing provision. Vienna is a wonderful alternative. Barcelona is another city now that is building social housing. You know, it's a kind of, regardless of what happens at the national level in Spain, the city government of Barcelona is very actively building this municipal social safety net anchored in particularly social housing, which they're constantly developing. But I think, though, to turn back to the question, I think what we will eventually develop in this country might look different. I think community land trusts or cooperatives.
Yeah, let's talk a bit more about these two models. The limited equity co-op, what does that mean? In New York, we have the Mitchell Lama housing, right? Was an example of that?
Yes. So limited equity co-op means that you have an apartment in a building, or it can be, you know, scattered house in a series of houses, and you are a shareholder in this cooperative that then owns the building or the larger property. And the limited equity is a really important part, which is you own a share and you can sell a share. You can pass it on to your descendants, but what you can get out of the building will not be the market rate for it. It's your equity in it is limited. There's a big portion of the wealth accumulated in that building that's just collectively owned and can't be individually sold. And the importance of that is that it prevents this kind of speculation with it. And we know in New York, unfortunately, some of the limited equity co-ops have changed their rules sometimes in the past years because Under limited equity rules, you might be able to sell your apartment for $40,000. But if somehow the building managed to change its cooperative rules and made it kind of full equity, it might be 10 times that. So one of the things we hope the next generation of limited equity cooperatives do is have stronger guardrails against that. Because, you know, if you have limited equity, it limits the amount of speculation in a building, and we see it as putting brakes on gentrification.
Yeah, well, this is the classic instance of individual self-interest versus collective interest, because the collective interest is in preventing housing speculation to make housing affordable. But if you're very well positioned, then you'd like to make that 10-for-1 killing when you sell the place.
Yeah, and you can't blame individuals. But at the same time, the reason that apartment is so nice is because of the collective effort, right? It is one of those classic cases. There are cooperatives. The Montevideo example I was giving you is fully non-alienable. In other words, you get no equity if you move out. You'd imagine this kind of thing would be difficult in this country, but that was the solution that they came up with.
Yeah, that sounds very un-American.
Yes, completely.
And then a community land trust, what's that?
So a community land trust is, in essence, it is a similar arrangement, but basically you take a piece of land off of the market. The land, and then a nonprofit or a cooperative develops it in one way or another. There's a very famous one in Burlington, Vermont. There's a famous Dudley Street one in Boston. But essentially, you have, you know, you're basically developing housing and cooperatives and commerce on top of publicly managed land. So the idea of a land trust means you're shepherding it, but you can't sell it. So what you've done is you've taken that part out of the speculative equation. Its impact is that housing on these community land trusts tends to be much more affordable. They've done really well weathering, you know, some folks have looked at what happens to community land trusts during the last housing crisis, and it's impressive. They actually had very few evictions. Very few people went under in quite the same way. It's one of those individual collective things, but collectively, you're more resilient to these shocks.
That one in Burlington, was that Mayor Bernie Sanders doing?
That is completely Mayor Bernie Sanders. It's a very nice, large community land trust. It's in Burlington, so it's not representative of the different kinds of demographic contexts in this country. It tends to be slightly more homogenous than some of the other places we go to. But it's a very well-functioning, now, I think, in its 40th year.
And why these sorts of arrangements rather than traditional public housing?
This is kind of a tricky thing for us to do, to talk about on the left. So we have to defend and improve public housing. But the reality is most public housing is woefully underfunded. And in addition, there is corruption and badly run bureaucracies around it. The difference between public housing in that way, in the cooperatives and in these kinds of models, is resident control. So one of the ways in which public housing, to my mind, is almost outside of the concept of social housing is that residents have very little control over trivial things, let alone important things. You know, if you visit a co-op or a land trust or a resident-owned community anywhere in the U.S., people will want to take you to the playground they built together, the mural, the shop. If you go to public housing, people can't even decide the colors of the walls of the common rooms, right? So that kind of bureaucratic top-down thing is different in these cooperative models, first. Second, you know, there is such a negative association with public housing in the U.S. When we give these talks and when we do these presentations, people always feel good hearing about community land trusts and cooperatives. It kind of resonates somehow in a way that everyone has a negative story about public housing. Whether it's earned or not, these cooperatives are more palatable, and we think they provide a greater sense of community control. And I think, too, there's a critique we get sometimes when we're talking about social housing, which is for many people, and many people of color in particular, ownership and home ownership is a vehicle of creation and transmission of wealth. And so the idea of a cooperative of limited equity, of at least having a share that your family owns, turns out to be important. and resonant in political palatability.
I'm speaking with the sociologist Gianpaolo Baiocchi, co-author of a proposal to create a social housing authority in the U.S. The Social Housing Development Authority, what's the proposal? Who would charter it? Who would govern it? What would it do?
So I would say this is a proposal, you know, co-authored by myself, Jay Carlson, and we have this great group of people that includes Marnie Brady, Ned Crowley, Sarah Duvisac. There's been this idea kicking around the housing advocacy world, which is, one, we need to stop and do something about this private equity takeover of residential real estate that is about to happen. We are going to be spending billions of dollars in bailouts and in vouchers, and we're going to get no public stake, and the problems of housing are still going to be the same. If we pay back every cent of housing debt by tenants, we're still going to be in the same situation we were before the pandemic. So this idea...
There's an enormous amount of rental arrears that have built up, and we really haven't even taken accounting of this problem or begun to deal with it, right? This is an enormous problem that's, you know, sort of festering, not fully in view of the general public. Certainly, it's very much in view of the people involved. But, you know, as a political issue, it just hasn't ripened. But it's really going to be a problem when, you know, some of these moratoria and such expire.
Yeah. All the figures that we have, it's 50, 60, 70 billions of dollars. And that underestimates the problem because people have pawned things. People have put payments on credit cards, all kinds of stuff. It's really a huge problem. And people are still unemployed. So even if we pay back, and even if we pay forward 2-3 months, you know, it doesn't get to the structure of the problem. So one, we have to stop private equity, and two, we have to move, when we invest resources into this emergency, we have to think of ways to move it towards solutions that work and that are lasting and that transform this housing market. So the Fed, the Social Housing Development Authority, is this idea to use the federal government. It will be a new federal institution. Perhaps it would be under HUD. Perhaps it would be autonomous, with the mission of purchasing these distressed assets with an eye to rehabilitating them and bringing them to livable and environmental standards, and then financing their transfer. You know, in the very ideal scenario, we would have the very tenants that are living in some of these distressed properties be able to purchase them through a cooperative. And this institution would facilitate that. And in many cases, we imagine it would actually subsidize it. In other words, we do not think that buying office space in Manhattan and turning it into housing and selling it at market price would be affordable necessarily. So this is admittedly a big picture and a kind of strong intervention, but we feel like this is going to be a huge political problem coming up, as you're saying. And the nature of our housing crisis in this country is just, it's just obscene. It's hard to imagine how a country as rich as this can continue with this terrible, terrible housing situation. This would be a large-scale investment in turning vacant, distressed, unused properties into social housing.
So they would initially be capitalized by the federal government and then borrow money at treasury rates and begin this acquisition process. Is that the idea?
That's right. Some of the funds would come back because in some cases it would sell it at market price, even when it sells it below market price. When it's holding the properties, because we imagine that once you take over a property, this entity would have to hold it for some time, you know, it would collect rent. So some funds would come back, but yes, there would have to be an investment of resources, a big investment of resources to make a dent into this housing problem that we have.
You mentioned in your paper the Resolution Trust Corporation, which was created to deal with the savings and loan crisis. But a lot of these interventions that the government has done over the decades have been designed merely to return things to private ownership, just to eat the losses and then turn them over to private owners again, right? You want to step out of that model and come up with something more innovative.
Yeah, so absolutely. You know, HULC, the Homeowners Loan Corporation, absorbed, refinanced, and kept people in their homes. And we think people during the last crisis, people talked about a bad assets bank. So this would be a kind of bad assets bank, but then it would turn it over to the cooperative sector, the social housing sector, non-market sector. We would see this as a federal intervention with the purpose of socializing housing, with an eye to making it permanently affordable. Yeah, so this is definitely beyond what the federal government has done.
So it would acquire this housing and then do what with it?
So it would acquire the housing. Our experience in speaking with advocates and people involved in some of these types of experiences would be that first it needs to be returned to livability. You know, what happens in reality with derelict properties, rundown properties, distressed properties is that the landlord has been skimping on maintenance for a long, long time, and these are in terrible condition. So first of all, it needs to hold and stabilize. Second, it would bring it up to environmental standards. We see this as companion effort related to Green New Deal types of efforts, a recognition that housing is such a big part of our carbon footprint. So making buildings and residences more green. And then in this time, so we imagine, say, this is holding the property for a year or 18 months, 2 years, then it would turn it over and offer it for sale. It would have a priority order. So the first would be to the tenants, the former tenants themselves, if it's a residential property, if they're able to form a cooperative and purchase it. If not, to the nonprofit housing sector. You know, there's many, many wonderful nonprofits that provide such important housing. You know, Housing Works here in New York is one of them, for example. But we would also imagine that in some instances, a local government might simply want to buy it and manage it. So this entity that we're imagining, the Social Housing Development Authority, would not be a permanent landlord. It would not be in the business of managing these properties. It really would be about turning it over either to cooperatives, nonprofits, or even to local authorities who want to purchase it as public housing.
Now, what about looking beyond troubled assets? What about developing new housing? Could you apply this model to the development of new housing as well?
Yes. We describe in the paper that the first order of business would be these distressed residential units. Second, there is all kinds of vacant real estate from commercial, office space, shopping malls. But we imagine very much within the remit of this entity to develop new social housing. The deficit in housing, in affordable housing in this country, is in the hundreds of thousands of units every year that this deficit grows. And with this will be the remit with a kind of activist board and proper funding, would be able to build these types of models newly.
The longer-term goal would also be to take a big chunk of the housing market out of the market, right? It was to remove the speculative element of housing, aside from these small, the relatively small number of properties we're talking about, the distressed properties. What about ambitions towards the transformation of the whole housing sector?
Yeah, so this is our biggest picture of all. I feel like we've had 60 or 70 years of empirical evidence that the private market cannot, will not provide permanently affordable quality housing for lower income people. We spent trillions of dollars over these years in subsidies, coaxing the private market, giving tax breaks, vouchers, all kinds of stuff. And the housing context is terrible. For low income people, the percentage of people who have unaffordable housing is very, very high. It's almost half if you're in the lower quintile, right? So we think, first, have a livable country. Some percentage of housing provision needs to be in the social housing sector, needs to be public housing, needs to be non-market, non-speculative housing. And this is one of, we think of this as a kind of transition sort of institution. You know, it won't happen overnight. Talking about Burlington and Vienna all the time is fine and good, but we need to think about the institutions that are actually going to get in and begin to move this political economy. And we think probably there need to be other companion kinds of institutions and moves that we need to make. Very strong rent control nationally and rent caps might be one of them. This fiscal structure that we have that ties the fates of communities to the local tax base is something that will need to be addressed eventually. But we see the moment now for this crisis as a, you know, allow us to insert a wedge and begin to build in that direction. But absolutely, that is the bigger vision. How do we get housing provision provided in a way that's not market-based.
Finally, it's never been easy to be a socialist in America. Not quite as hard as it was a few years ago, but it's still quite hard. What's the sales pitch here? Because, you know, this seems so against the American grain, which is so much centered on the private house, the American dream, all that kind of talk. People want their piece of the action and hope it's going to make them, if not rich, at least, you know, improve their economic standing. How do you convince them to depart from convention and take this bold step?
Yeah, that. Well, I'm looking to you, but I'm also looking to the younger people. Well, you know, all these wonderful elected progressives that we have now in New York State, this new generation of people to make that pitch. But I think you're absolutely right. I think we have to think about an American dream beyond that doesn't involve home ownership will be tricky. But I think actually for us, the moment is pretty good to make the pitch. No one is against cooperatives, I think, or is at least palatable. Private equity is such a bad actor and has been such a bad actor with housing. And we have this really unsustainable situation that is going to explode. Before the pandemic, 1 million school children slept in cars every night. So there's something so fundamentally wrong with our housing provision. So I think that's the sales pitch. We got a crisis, we have solutions that work, and we need to step in and empower communities to decide their own fate. So you'll notice we don't talk about socialism in the paper, but we do talk about communities, which I guess people like in the United States, right? It's that sells.
We profess to. I don't know whether we actually do, but we profess to. That was John Paolo Biocchi, a sociology professor at NYU and co-author of a paper on creating a social housing development authority in the U.S. The authors did a short journalistic version of the proposal for the New York Times in early March. You can find the full paper on the NYU Urban Democracy Lab's website. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a real oldie, some of Captain Beefheart's My Head Is My Only House Unless It Rains. Till next week, bye.
Train, be my feet if it's too far to walk to you. If a train don't go there, I'll get a jet or a bus, 'cause I'm gonna find you. You're gonna see my shadow soon around you. In my head is my only house unless it rains. I walk the meadow plains while the desert's on my eyes until I find you.